I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Municipalities in Pennsylvania are starting to receive funds from impact fees paid by companies drilling in the state's gas-rich Marcellus Shale, part of Act 13 signed by Governor Corbett. The state has experienced a dramatic increase in natural gas drilling in the last few years. Our guests Susan Phillips and Scott Detrow have been covering the economic and environmental impact of the natural gas boom for State Impact PA. That's a collaboration between WHYY, NPR, and WITF. They won an Edward R. Murrow Regional Award from the Radio Television Digital News Association for their work earlier this year. And they join us to talk about the legacy of abandoned oil wells, energy and the election, the debate over clean coal, and much more. Susan Phillips has worked as a reporter for WHYY since 2004. She joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Susan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And on the telephone, Scott Detrow, Harrisburg, a reporter for State Impact PA, and he was Pennsylvania's public radio state capital bureau chief from 2009 to 2011. And Scott, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well. We have to get Scott up and running. Do we have him? I hear noise, but I don't hear Scott. We will fix that. Susan, let me begin with you. And we talk about the boom, the natural gas boom in Pennsylvania. Is it still booming?
Depends where you are. You know, recently I was up in northeast Pennsylvania, Marty, and I was hitchhiking with a poet up there who is creating a whole documentary of the gas rush through his poetry and the way he gathers his materials through hitchhiking. And a lot of the rides that we got when folks were talking to us it seemed to indicate that things weren't booming as well. Now, when you're up there, there's still lots of traffic. You still see evidence of gas drilling. But for instance, I heard from one ride that picked us up that his cousins used to work for the gas industry and were working 7 days a week, you know, 50 hours a day. And now they're getting like one day a month up there, and that things are heading sort of west towards eastern Ohio, where the gas is called wet gas. It's more profitable for the companies. There's such a low price of natural gas right now that it seems more profitable for them to move west where they can get, you know, a higher price commodity.
And I'm assuming the price is low because there's just a glut
exactly.
of natural gas.
Exactly.
Because of all the drilling that's going on.
Right. And that's partly due to the, you know, shale gas rush.
Let me see if we have Scott Detrow. Scott, are you with us?
I'm with you now, Marty. How
good.
You doing?
Nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Scott, I also want to I was just talking with Susan Phillips about this boom of natural gas here in the state of Pennsylvania, but I also want to talk to you about a series that you had at State Impact PA about these abandoned oil wells across the state of Pennsylvania. How many abandoned wells are there? Does anyone know?
There's way more than I initially thought when I started reporting on this. You know, the Marcellus Shale is not Pennsylvania's first energy boom. We hosted the world's very first oil well in 1859. And for the first 30 or 40 years after that, Pennsylvania was the center of the drilling universe. And, of course, in those days, there was no Department of Environmental Protection or Environmental Protection Agency. There weren't really many rules at all. So people just drilled wells all over the place. And when the wells stopped producing oil or gas, they just took off. They left it. Maybe they put a tree trunk down or sometimes a cannonball, and that was the most they would do. So Pennsylvania, since the mid-80s, has been working very hard to figure out where these wells are. They have a database of about 8,000 wells, and the really alarming thing is that those 8,000 abandoned wells, that accounts for maybe, at best, 4% of the wells they think are out there. The state and energy experts think that there are probably 200,000 oil and gas wells that are abandoned, dotting the state, mostly in the western part of the state.
In fact, I looked at your map, and you can see at least where some of these wells have been identified, and I'm assuming that's where the oil was at that time.
That's right. That's where they were drilling, in the Titusville area. Then they moved over to McKean County, kind of hugging the northern border of New York with New York State around Erie. And this is a problem because when these wells aren't filled, they become kind of a pathway for natural gas to migrate up to the surface. That can happen on its own. And a couple times, and we saw this summer, and that's what really got me started on this project, when you're drilling a new Marcellus Shale well, and you put that drill bit, you lay that pipe through a surface, gas that's closer to the surface, sometimes that'll poke into the same gas formation where these old wells are situated, and that kind of causes the gas to start moving again, to start migrating, and it looks for a low pressure zone. It finds that pipe from that old well, and it shoots to the surface. And in Tioga County in June, Shell was drilling near an abandoned well, and the next thing you knew, there was a geyser of natural gas and water shooting out of the ground at the surface for more than a week. So there's serious implications when you drill near these things, and the problem is nobody knows where they are for the most part.
Now, this is under the responsibility of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. It's their job to what, find out where these wells are?
That's right, and it's hard to find them because a lot of them had steel casing, but over time, scrap collectors would come in and rip that out of the ground. There were big scrap drives during both world wars. So that's often the only thing that you can find on the surface because these holes kind of, you know, get eroded in toward the top over time. And you also have towns that have built up, cities that have built up. When they're drilling in rural areas, kind of the forest would reclaim itself or maybe a farmer would plow over it. So it's really hard to tell. There are ways to get a head start on these. One thing that people do is, well, first you look for old records. You go to county courthouses. You go to historical societies looking for those original filings, those land deals that got the drilling started. Another way is to use aerial photos, historic aerial photos. The state has a database going back to 1937. So you can say, okay, was somebody drilling around here in that point in time? Okay, that looks like an access road. That looks like a well pad. Let's check in that area. Mm-hmm. But often you just have to get out and search by foot, and it's very time-consuming. And one of the interesting things I found is that when you apply for a natural gas drilling permit in Pennsylvania, there's a whole series of checklists that you have to go through. Are you drilling near a coal mine? Are you drilling near an old coal seam? Are you drilling near a private water well, a stream, a building, things like that? And we were surprised to find that abandoned wells are not one of the things that you have to check off. There's no responsibility for the drillers to say, okay, there's no abandoned wells within 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet. There is a proposal to change that, but that's going through the Department of Environmental Protection's regulatory process, but that might take another 2 years to do. And that's actually the case with most of the states that are hosting shale booms right now that also have a long drilling history. Texas is like that, too. Oklahoma is like that, too. The only state that requires these drillers to go out and look for these wells is Ohio. And when you talk to environmental officials, they say, well, this is something that the drillers are doing anyway. It's in their interest to find these wells and plug them because, you know, they don't want the major problems that pop up when they do run into these wells. And again, it's only happened a handful of times so far, but it seems like an interesting gap to us. And that one part of our four-part series took a look at that permitting process and whether or not abandoned wells play a role in it.
Let me see what Susan Phillips has to say. And I know you've written about methane migration. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yes, that's how methane can migrate. There's other ways for it to do it, but a lot of the reason why we do have these problems in Pennsylvania with methane migration is not just the well casings themselves, the new wells that are poorly constructed, but also these abandoned wells that, as Scott said, can serve as a conduit. And just to give people a picture of how this works, I was out in a swamp earlier this year, last February, and the reason I was there was I was with some old trappers, and they were worried about abandoned wells in the area. They knew where the abandoned wells were. They took me and showed me where these abandoned wells were, and one had oil spilling up out of it.
I mean, bubbling up?
Yeah.
Flowing
up into the swamp. It was really oily, slicky water, disgusting stuff all around this shaved off piece of metal. And the reason they were worried about these abandoned wells was not so much because there was drilling happening nearby, but because there were plans to dispose of drilling wastewater in nearby wells. And they were afraid that these abandoned wells would serve as a conduit for the drilling frack water or wastewater to come back up to the surface and pollute surface water. And the old timers who were drillers that I've talked to have told me that, you know, before 1955, when Pennsylvania, you know, finally, you know, created its first oil and gas law, the rule or the commonplace method to plug a well was to use a white pine log.
I mean, and just sort of jam it in there?
Jam it in there and hope for the best. And when I spoke to the EPA about this, one of the people told me, oh, well, you know, it's really easy to find these wells when it snows. You just go out and where there's no snow, that's an abandoned well. So, like Scott said, it is a really big problem. And people have wells on their property that are abandoned that they don't even know about.
Well, Scott, even going back to you and picking up on what Susan just said, so if once a well is discovered, how is it plugged today? If I'm assuming they're not jamming logs down it, but what are they doing instead?
No, we've moved on from logs and cannonballs. It's cement plays a key role. You can either cement the entire well bore shut from start to finish. More typically, they put little plugs of cement in the gas or oil bearing zones that the well goes through. When you drill this well, you've got a record of, okay, we know there's a shale layer here, we know there's a layer here. So you'll have, three or four kind of, chunks of cement along the way through the mm-hmm. pipe. And sometimes they'll put like a gel-like substance in between, sometimes they won't. And then when it's done, they put what's called a monument on top. The ones that I saw in Northwest Pennsylvania kind of look like those cigarette butt stands that you see up next to trash cans sometimes. It's kind of a steel pipe sticking out of the ground with a thick base, and there's a serial number on top so that if you're interested, you can look up and find the relevant permits. Okay, this well was drilled mm-hmm. this year. It was plugged in that year.
And are there efforts now that, I mean, clearly the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has known about this problem, Scott, and mm-hmm. Are there efforts to, if not revisit Act 13, to at least look at some of these permits and include these abandoned wells?
Well, what they're doing, in terms of the how to deal with the previous wells, there is this division in DEP that's been charged with filling these wells since the late 80s. And they've closed about 2,000 of them. Their limitation is just manpower and money. They're funded by a fee that drillers pay when they get a drilling license. It's $150 or $250. And that goes into this fund that they use to tap the wells. There's also been other revenue sources over the years. That growing greener bond generated a lot of money for environmental issues in the early 2000s. They got a lot of money from that. And they've been able to fill a couple hundred of these wells a year, but the head of the department, said it's essentially triage. Susan talked about that well that's leaking in the swamp. If they see a well, but it's in the middle of the forest and it's not near anybody's home, they're probably not going to plug it because they need to save their money for those wells that are discovered on someone's property that suddenly starts to leak methane. After we published the series, somebody sent me a note and said, hey, this exact thing is going on in Sullivan County, and we looked into it. And it was that situation where all of a sudden a person had methane leaking into his basement. He called the state. They have temporarily evacuated him, and they rushed to fill that well to stop that leak.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Scott Detrow and Susan Phillips. They're reporters for State Impact PA. That's a collaboration between WHYY, NPR, and WITF covering the fiscal and environmental impact of Pennsylvania's booming energy economy with a focus on Marcellus shale drilling. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Agnes Irwin School supports WHYY and is hosting an open house for all grades on Sunday, October 21st from 2 to 4 p.m. on its campus located at Ithan Avenue and Conestoga Road in Rosemont. With all girls education pre-K through grade 12, families and prospective students are invited to meet students and faculty, tour the campus, and learn more about the Agnes Irwin experience firsthand. For more information, 610-525-8400 or online at agnesirwin.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We have a challenge today on Radio Time so that we can meet our overall goal for the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. If we hear from 60 listeners, this generous donor will give WHYY an additional $1,200. Our thanks to that donor and thanks to you when you pick up the phone and make a pledge right now. 1-888-345-9499 or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
The Wistar Institute supports WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. The newest cancer treatments almost always start with a breakthrough in basic science research. Wistar researchers identify the causes of cancer, and this can lead to treatments that directly target the causes, without the harmful side effects of older cancer therapies. Basic research saves lives and needs your support. To learn more about how you can join us and help save lives, wistar.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are catching up on some stories that Susan Phillips and Scott Detrow have been doing about natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania. They're reporters for State Impact PA, and they've been covering some really fascinating stories. We began talking with Scott about the problem of abandoned oil wells in the state of Pennsylvania. And Susan, I want to talk to you about a piece that you did recently headlined as Election Nears, A New Debate Over Clean Coal. That has come up in the presidential debate. Has come up in other debates and discussions as well. As you write about it, there it sort of depends on which side of the environment that you stand on, how you define what clean coal is. Help us understand why this is an important thing to understand.
Well, it suddenly reared its ugly head now. Like, you know, before the shale gas rush, you heard all about clean coal, right? Because we had this problem with CO2 emissions, and CO2 emissions cause, you know, help cause global warming, and we all want to stop global warming. But as soon as the price of natural gas and the plentiful supplies of natural gas, the price plummeted, the supplies went up. There was a lot there. You'll be seeing right now, actually, a lot of power plants switching to natural gas or new power plants being powered by natural gas. In fact, sometimes entire factories. I was up in Northeast Pennsylvania, and the Procter & Gamble factory up there is about to be, you know, completely powered by natural gas and
switching
off the grid. Yeah. Well, the grid was partly coal. They were dependent on the grid, and now they're going to be completely off the grid and using their own natural gas that's beneath their land. But so what happened was the coal industry, you know, sort of was struggling with you know, their survival. And nobody really sort of had predicted this years earlier. And at the same time, the EPA is putting in these new regulations that would make it really difficult for some of these old power plants to continue to operate based on what they're putting out into the air. So the coal industry is blaming the EPA and Obama, right? And they're saying, oh, there's a war on coal. Too many regulations. This is an abundant, cheap supply, a domestic supply. We wouldn't have to be dependent on, you know, foreign oil. We've got 200 years worth of coal beneath our land to burn. So, they really are targeting the Obama administration and the EPA. So back to this clean coal.
I was going to say, because it's all interrelated.
It's all interrelated.
But they have an interesting definition of how they define clean coal.
Right. And so the coal industry, and you may have noticed this, you know, if you're watching TV, is, you know, they have all these ads right now about clean coal and how they've become cleaner. And if you drive down the turnpike, you can see billboards that say increasingly green, always red, white, and blue coal. And so what they define loosely as clean coal are things like scrubbers. Right. I mean, there's a lot of new technology that helps reduce the amount of particulates or, you know, sulfur dioxide, nitrous dioxide that causes air pollution, smog, things like asthma, heart attacks, congestive heart failure, all these things that make our air dirty. They have developed new technology to help reduce that. Now,
they're called scrubbers. Well, generally speaking, called scrubbers.
There's a lot of different things, but yeah, right. People know them. You know, there's a couple things called scrubbers, but basically, it's easy to picture they're scrubbing the dirt off the emissions and, you know, trying to put it somewhere else. So that sort of, you know, that takes care of part of what's coming out of coal plants.
But as you have written, it doesn't remove the CO2.
It does not remove the CO2.
Okay,
which is the issue with climate change, right?
And as you have written, when you look at even, and I know you interviewed Governor Rendell, but even the Obama administration, their notion of clean coal is that you capture the CO2, in a sense, inject it in the ground, preventing it from being released into the atmosphere, something called carbon capture and sequestration. That's
right.
Their definition.
That's
of clean
their
coal.
Definition. When you know, Rendell would speak about clean coal, that's his definition. When Obama speaks about clean coal, that's his definition. When Romney speaks about clean coal, that is not his definition.
He's a scrubber type.
Right, right. And the reason is, and just to say, the environmentalists will say, you know, there is no such thing as clean coal because there's so many parts of the process that are dirty and that cannot be cleaned up. But when it comes to the clean coal Obama definition, that's decades away. I mean, you talk to researchers and a lot of people think this is a pie in the sky idea, that this is never going to be, you know, economically feasible to happen. And the coal industry is worried it's not going to be economically feasible in time, you know, for them to be able to, you know, clean up their act and comply with the new EPA rules.
Scott, can I get you in on this? Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think what I have to add is more about the economics of the issue and the so-called war on coal. Susan's really taken the lead on the environmental side with us. But, you know, has the Obama administration tightened regulations on coal? Absolutely. But I think the much bigger factor is just the simple economics of natural gas drilling. I've talked to people whose job it is to trade coal on the markets, and they say, look, natural gas is at these record low prices right now, but even if natural gas gets back to where it was before, it's still so much cheaper to produce than operating a full-blown coal mine. It's much easier once you have the pipelines and infrastructure in place to get it from point A to point B. It's so much cheaper to sell that the coal industry is focusing its attention on getting its product overseas, especially, you know, the Chinese marketplaces like that. And they've said that that's so much the case that China is really setting the demand. And this is how much we're going to pay for your bulk coal, and we know we're going to get it because you can't sell it anywhere else right now. So it's just a shifting market. And if you look at the rounds and rounds of layoffs that have started happening at coal mining operations, coal producing operations, especially in West Virginia, there was a large streak this year of just big companies having to lay people off. They say, look, this really comes down to natural gas drilling and the ongoing shale boom that Pennsylvania plays a lead role in, and that's just changing our domestic energy picture.
And that's Scott Detrow, who joins us along with Susan Phillips, both reporters for State Impact PA, covering the fiscal and environmental impact of Pennsylvania's booming energy economy with a focus on Marcellus shale drilling. We are talking about drilling in Marcellus shale. We are also talking about larger energy issues as well, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And energy has certainly come up in some of the presidential, even the vice presidential debate as well. Susan, let me go back to you, because the EPA did come up with stricter standards for new coal plants.
Right.
How strict are they?
Well, they're strict enough that, you know, this we're talking about the CO2 emissions.
Exactly.
Well, they're strict enough that new coal-fired plants wouldn't be able to meet those regulations, whereas natural gas plants could easily meet them. So, as Scott said, there's the environmental influence in this dynamic, but there's also a lot of economic influence in this dynamic, too. And so what you're seeing is a sort of shift of our national energy landscape, so to speak. And it's just important when people hear the term clean coal to understand that there's many different definitions out there. So if two people are arguing about clean coal, they might be arguing about two separate things.
Well, Scott, let me go back to you. And another economic issue, municipalities, as I said at the top of the hour, in Pennsylvania beginning to receive money from that impact fee that was that is levied on natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania. What is the formula that's being used? Because it's interesting to see who's getting what as this money is being redistributed.
Sure. And one last quick point on coal. I forgot to throw this number out there. There's 14 coal-fired power plants in Pennsylvania that have said they're going to have to shut down due to this confluence of the economy and new regulations. On to the impact fee.
Yes.
The municipal formula is pretty tricky. It involves how many wells are in the municipality. It involves, among other factors, the amount of state roads going through the municipality. It's tricky to figure out. The large scale, 60% of all the money generated in total, Pennsylvania got about $204 million out of this first round of impact fees. 60% is divvied up among counties and local governments that host Marcellus Shale wells. If you've got a well in your county, you've got for every well, the state collected about $50,000, a bit lower if it was a smaller scale operation. Essentially, you get about 60% of that. And municipal fees, again, like I said, it's complicated to figure out. But in total, earlier this week, the state announced how much money each municipality is going to receive, how much money each county is going to receive. We've got those figures on the State Impact Pennsylvania website. The lowest amount, there were about 15 townships that are getting less than $10. So I've been meaning to call some of these county supervisors and ask what they're going to do with their $4 impact fee check. But there's a handful that are receiving more than $500,000, a couple approaching $1 million. And they can use – there are restrictions on what they can use them for, but essentially – if it's a local impact of drilling, they're able to direct that money that way, and that goes to infrastructure repair. That goes to housing subsidies, because the reality is, as drillers have rushed into these markets, rent in a lot of these rural communities has skyrocketed. It goes for emergency services, police protection. We did a lot of reporting on the fact that, you know, it's not necessarily that drillers are a rowdy bunch of people. It's just that anytime you dump a couple hundred or a couple thousand new people into a community, you're going to have more accidents. You're going to have more police calls. So a lot of areas like that, they'll be able to use the funding.
Well, hold on one second, Scott, because sure. I do want to get some callers in, but also going back to Susan, because we were talking about this before we went on the air. Now, interestingly, Philadelphia is getting a bit more than $1 million.
That's right.
There are some counties that are getting several million. Is that right, Susan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Bradford County, I think, is almost $8.5 million. Is that right, Scott? I mean,
that's right.
That's one of the heaviest drilling areas in the state right now. And that's without the different municipalities, what the different municipalities in Bradford County would get.
Yeah, Marty, there's kind of a formula. There's that 60% that there's it's a mathematical, you have this many wells, you get this much money. But that 40% that went into the state, a lot of that was filtered back to counties to be used for competitive grants for infrastructure repair, things like that. So you're right, Philadelphia gets $1.3 million. Bucks County is going to receive $530,000, Montgomery County $680,000, and Chester County $423,000. And that's with no drilling going on in these counties. That's just how the statewide formula shakes out. And it's interesting. I think Philadelphia, in the end, receives about the same, if not a little bit more money, than Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh is, where there is drilling going on.
Well, that's very interesting. And let me get some callers in. It looks like we have Bill from Cochranville joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How y'all doing this morning?
Good. How are you?
Okay. I have a couple of comments. I'm in from the state of Indiana. I live in Gary. My dad happens to be in the hospital, so I'm here for family.
Oh,
anyhow, I was born and raised in Philly. But a couple of comments. I spent 32 years. I'm a retired steel worker, so I'm a I spent almost 15 years in a coke plant turning coal into coke. And without any pollution equipment, we generated approximately 250,000 tons of dirt and dust every year. And I watched cars melt in the parking lot from this stuff. And, I breathed my share. So I understand there's no such thing as clean coal. Come on, give me a break. When you burn coal, you're burning something pretty nasty. Better to turn it into diamonds. I do have a couple comments. As a steel worker, it seems to me, for energy saving, most of the equipment in our house could run off of 24 volts. Why aren't we putting simple solar panels on the roof, putting a dual voltage system in the house? We can run our lights, run our computer, run most of the things in our house off of a 24-volt system. Batteries, battery backup with a charger, and simple solar system. Put in low voltage lighting. It would create a new industry in America created millions of jobs and save a lot of energy.
Well, Bill, let me just take your point, because I know you have a lot to say. We also have some more callers as well, and I do want to take your points. I mean, he's saying from his own experience, Susan, that clean coal doesn't exist.
Right, and a lot of people agree with him. I think it's one of those issues where, you know, how do you define – they use these terms in a manipulative way. I mean, right? I mean, everyone wants, you know, to think that there is such a thing as clean coal if you're trying to make money off of electric generation. But, yes, he's right. I mean, at the end of the day, can you make it completely clean? No. Mm. No.
Well, and Bill is also talking about, and I'll just toss this quickly to you, Scott, and what one hears from President Obama, and I think to some degree, although I think a lesser degree, from Governor Romney, kind of an all-of-the-above solution to our energy needs.
Mm-hmm. The tough thing with that alternative energy, solar, wind, things like that, pretty broad consensus, this is not going to get up and running without heavy subsidization, heavy grant funding from governments going forward. Pennsylvania put in a portfolio standard during the Rendell administration saying, you know, by X date, X percent of our energy is going to come from alternative sources. Of course, the Obama administration was aggressive about handing out grants, loan guarantees for alternative energy. And when Solyndra went bankrupt, that really backfired in the president's face. And now Governor Romney, a big part of his platform is blasting the Obama administration for spending this money on alternative energy. So it's become, you know, and of course the New York Times has done some reporting about how aggressive Governor Romney was about developing those same wind sources, solar sources when he was governor. So it kind of becomes a political football, and that has led to halts and starts and stops in developing that alternative energy across the country. That being said, there's always, every time you drive down the turnpike, there's more wind farms popping up. So this is something that's expanding here.
Let me get Ed from Cape May to join us on Radio Times. Ed, we're almost up on a break, but go ahead. Ask your question.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Yes. I have a friend of mine who has a place in the Poconos, and they're getting ready to run a pipeline or whatever through his property. And he showed me the list of the chemicals that they're going to use to shake this oil off the shale rock. Wow. I'll tell you right now, I wouldn't want to be drinking the water. That's all I can tell you, and I don't know how long it's going to take before they figure it out. But I don't care who's involved. I know there's money to be made, or if it's going to make a difference in the price of oil and fuel for people. But you want to see the liquid chemicals. It's scary.
Well, Ed, I appreciate the call to Radio Time. Susan, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, a lot of people are worried about the chemicals used to frack a well. And, you know, there's so much controversy over whether or not that will have short-term or long-term impacts on the water supply. There's one study that's the EPA did about Pavilion, Wyoming. There's still lots of battles over what actually happened in Pavilion. Did fracking, you know, pollute the aquifer there? Did it not? In the meantime, there are people all across Pennsylvania who have experienced problems with their water supply. And oftentimes it cleans itself up, right? You know, their water's bad, or their well runs dry, and then things get better. And other times it doesn't. Mm. And it's a very it's hard to connect the dots as to how that actually happened.
Well, we have to take a very short break, and we have to say goodbye to you, Scott Detrow. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And Scott Detrow, reporter for State Impact PA. Susan Phillips, also reporter for State Impact PA, staying with us. And we have waiting in the wings Darren Samuelson. He's White House reporter for Politico. We'll be talking about how energy and the election are connecting. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-672-4900. That's 215-672-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We have a challenge today on Radio Time so that we can meet our overall goal for the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. If we hear from 60 listeners, this generous donor will give WHYY an additional $1,200. Our thanks to that donor and thanks to you when you pick up the phone and make a pledge right now, 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks very much.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The new partnership of Yannick Naizé-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra has begun. Yannick conducts Brahms' Fourth Symphony, and violin virtuoso Joshua Bell plays Leonard Bernstein's eloquent Serenade. Tickets at philorg.org and 215-893-1999. October 25th, 26th, and 27th at the Kimmel Center, Brahms and Joshua Bell with Yannick Naizé-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Fracking is a big and important issue in Pennsylvania and other states with rich reservoirs of natural gas. Natural gas drilling and other sources of energy are also issues in the presidential campaign. We've been talking with Susan Phillips and Scott Detrow, reporters for State Impact PA, about the legacy of abandoned oil wells in Pennsylvania, definitions of clean coal, impact fees. We had to say goodbye to Scott. Susan Phillips staying with us. And joining us now is Darren Samuelson. He's White House reporter for Politico, who also covers energy and the environment, spent nearly a decade on the energy environment beat for E&E Publishing's Greenwire and Environment and Energy Daily. And Darren Samuelson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
It shouldn't be a big surprise that as Romney and Obama duke it out, the issue of energy has come up, certainly came up on Tuesday night, whether it had to do with gas prices or the Keystone Pipeline or renewables or all of the above solutions or drilling. One of the things that happened on Tuesday night was that Governor Romney blamed President Obama for the high price of gas. And I know that you have analyzed whether presidents do or don't control the price of gas. What did you find?
Yeah, this is something, unfortunately, for President Obama that, you know, he has to deal with the politics of gas prices, even though he doesn't really have a big say over what it's going to cost you tomorrow to pay at the pump. President Bush experienced this before, and every president really, as we've dealt with price shocks over the course of many decades, has had to deal with this. So here, President Obama, with gas prices at creeping back up to that $4 level, has had throughout his whole term tried to look like he's on top of the issue, but really has no immediate control. I mean, global oil prices are the biggest driver for how much you pay at the pump. And then there's a host of other economic reasons, supply, demand globally, sort of what the state of the economy is. And so right now, for President Obama at this point, he's, you know, got to deal with that. The things that he can do are really around the edges, you know, the releasing of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is a very, you know, sensitive topic to try and touch that one. He can, you know, make some changes with respect to some air pollution requirements in certain parts of the country. But really, it's something that politically is just tough for him. And, you know, he pointed out during the debate that when he took office, prices actually had dropped down to about $1.80. It was sort of a byproduct of that recession, the onslaught of the recession. But if you remember, just 6 months before that, in July of 2008, we were at 4.11, which was an all-time high. And people were talking about ways, you know, other gimmicks, I think was a word that Obama used, to suspend the gasoline tax. To try and deal with that.
But what we're dealing with is a global market. It's not as if there's American oil and then there's everybody else.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, and this gets into a lot of the debate that you hear about, you know, American energy independence and whether or not, you know, that would make much of a difference. And maybe longer term, it possibly could. But, you know, in the short term, not so much.
Well, you mentioned the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, but also on Tuesday night, there was the Keystone Pipeline came up, and this has come up in other venues that have presented or certainly discussed some of these positions by the various candidates. If the Keystone Pipeline were green lighted, would that have an impact on gas prices in the U.S.?
That's a good question. There's a heated debate over that point, and you'll hear from the environmental groups and from others who have been fighting it that, you know, this oil would come down and be processed in the Gulf Coast and then would end up just getting, you know, exported to other places. The Republicans are saying that, you can increase the domestic, the North American energy production, and therefore, you know, we would see some changes. And I think maybe medium term, that is possible. But you know, in the immediate, you know, if President Obama were to greenlight the southern route tomorrow, I don't think you would see gas prices come down, you know, the next day. So, or you know, even in a week or two or three. So that's clearly something that, you know, has become a political football here. This was a tough decision for President Obama to deal with. He had environmentalists leaning on him really hard, you know, protesting outside the White House, trying to get him to not permit this pipeline. Expectations now is if he did win a second term, he probably would approve it, no longer under the, you know, the fear of what the environmentalists might do in terms of walking away from him or you know, not writing checks and donating and you know, being as enthusiastic as they are. And they do make up a large component of his volunteer ground force. So obviously that was something that he kept in mind politically as he had to make that decision.
But this Keystone Pipeline is part of a larger network of pipelines.
That's true, absolutely. I mean, this would be a big one, and it would certainly open up, you know, the Canadian tar sands to, you know, the domestic markets. And so, you know, the ripple effects are such that, you know, you if you do increase production here, we're less reliant, I guess, on the global. This is at least thinking that we're less reliant on sort of the global fluctuations if we're producing more at home. And we have seen, you know, much greater production here at home, and our imports are at a much lower level than they've been over the last couple decades, and President Obama's been talking about that. So, you know, if there is Middle East unrest and oil prices were to shoot up, if we are more reliant on what's happening here in North America, that's the thinking goes, you know, we would be less have to worry about, you know, the global price shock. So that's sort of where the thinking goes on this.
And I do want to get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. But let me get you, Susan Phillips, back in on the conversation. Wait, there are some statewide races in Pennsylvania, some local races as well. Has the issue of energy and gas prices and Marcellus Shale, has all that come up in some of these races?
It has. What's interesting is some of the down ballot races, it has come up in some weird and unusual way. In you know the attorney general race, of course, that's Kathleen Kane, the Democrats, running against David Freed. There was a press release sent out by the state Republican Party, basically saying that Kathleen Kane was a hypocrite for taking gas money, or making money off of the shale rush, and being sort of critical of the gas industry. She's basically saying, look, we're not going to, you know, if anything comes to us to investigate or prosecute regarding, you know, pollution or some kind of fraud around leaseholders, then we will prosecute that.
And they were calling her a hypocrite, making money.
They were making her, well, they
but
were
as
calling
it turns
her,
out,
it turns out she wasn't making any money off the shale industry. Yeah, her husband, you know, has a family business up in Northeast Pennsylvania where they ship basically packaged goods all over the place. And they don't have anything to do with, you know, the shale rush up there. But what's interesting is that, you know, who's getting money from the gas industry? And it looks like, I mean, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette wrote about this earlier this week, where they took a look at who's giving money to who. Right. And it looks like primarily it's the Republicans who are getting the gas money, at least in the attorney general's race. Kathleen Kane hasn't gotten any, whereas David Freed has gotten, you know, thousands of dollars from gas drillers. And what the implication being, there are also some county commissioners who have gotten money from gas drillers. And the implication being, are we going to see further down the ballot, you know, at the county commissioner level or the state rep level, more money being poured into these campaigns from gas drillers?
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about how energy has become a part of both the presidential campaign and also some local races or statewide races in Pennsylvania. We have Mike from West Allegheny. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'd like to respectfully disagree with the woman, but the gentleman speaker, where he said the president doesn't control the cost of gas. He does. In fact, the administration does. It's called inflation, except the real definition of inflation has to do with the devalued dollar. They've turned on the printing presses. They've devalued their dollar. And in fact, so that sort of winds up being a tax on all of us when we have to pay more for all the commodities. We're in construction, so we see copper twice the price it was than 4 years ago, aluminum, all the primary metals. Has nothing to do with demand because we're only half the housing starts that we had, 6 years ago. So the demand doesn't shoot the price up. And the speculation might account for part of it. I certainly understand that. But I'd like them to take a closer look to see what percentage of those increases have to do with the fact that the rest of the world knows what our dollar's worth.
Well, Mike, let me see what Darren Samuelson has to say. Have you looked at that, Darren?
I haven't looked at sort of the broader inflation question that he brings up. It's a good point. But I really would say, though, that the actual pump price that you're paying on a day-and-night basis, certainly what your dollar is worth makes a big difference, the difference between paying $2 in 2004 for a gallon of gas versus the paying of $2 today. There is certainly something to be said for how far your dollar goes. The point that I'm trying to make here is that the President of the United States doesn't have a direct line to determine what the cost is at the pump. That is set by a much larger market.
Mike, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Dan from Malvern has to say. And Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Prior to natural gas fracking, I had the idea that the energy from mountaintop coal mining could be replaced by windmills on the mountaintop, solar photovoltaics on the already stripped and leveled mountaintops, and low-head hydro on the mountain streams. Could that renewable energy replace coal for electricity within the lifespan of the generating equipment and or maybe produce more electricity and get out more energy over the lifetime of the generating equipment?
Well, Dan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Darren, can I toss that to you? And there's obviously concern of trying to develop more renewable energy. Dan has an interesting idea. I'd be curious about your response.
I've heard a lot of talk of putting windmills on top of a mountaintop removal site. They've been used for a number of things. They put golf courses and prisons and strip malls on top of mountaintop removal sites too. So it's really, those are decisions that get made at a local state level, developer level, private industry level. What we're seeing these days is a surge in renewable electricity production across the country. We've seen more windmills, more solar, at pretty aggressive rates. Obviously, this has been part of a much broader political debate that's happened over how much to invest in green energy. The president put a very large amount of the stimulus dollars into green energy. A couple of those companies, high-profile companies, have gone belly up, and that has become part of the campaign fodder with the attacks from Mitt Romney and the Republicans saying that Obama was picking winners and losers, and the Obama campaign pushing back and saying, these companies are in need of some federal help, and there was obviously a large trough that they could pull from. That's where we kind of are at this point. The Republican attacks on clean energy have really kind of surprised me, I'd have to say, here in the last 2 years, given kind of where we were in that debate 4 years ago when McCain and Obama were running against each other. They seem to be largely on the same page on the overall purpose of clean energy with respect to climate change and talking about capping carbon emissions. But something happened there in that first 2 years with the rise of the Tea Party and Republican takeover of the House, where a lot of these words and phrases have become kind of, dirty words, in some respects. So we're in an interesting place right now with respect to the politics of renewable energy. And after this election, it'll be very interesting to see if we resort back to where we were 4 years ago, or does it kind of keep on this partisan break?
And that's Darren Samuelson joining us along with Susan Phillips talking about energy, the election, and economics. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Susan, I'm curious about how Pennsylvania stacks up when it comes to renewables. We've been focusing largely on Marcellus Shale and some of these abandoned oil wells, but how about wind and solar?
Well, it's interesting, Marty, because when you go out to western and northeastern Pennsylvania, you'll also see windmills right behind drill rigs. So, but the wind energy industry is worried right now because the production tax credit that benefits them is about to expire, and there's uncertainty as to whether that's going to get renewed. In Pennsylvania itself, there, as far as solar energy is concerned, it depends on this sort of complicated system of what they call SRECs, which are solar credits. Basically, there's a whole system of credits that you can get by producing solar energy, but that market has plummeted.
Oh.
Because there was basically a glut of solar energy credits out there.
People took advantage of
It was almost a victim of its own success. So in many ways, it's not as financially beneficial now, although that's not the case in New Jersey. In New Jersey, solar energy is booming. I mean, everywhere you go in New Jersey, you can see a solar panel. So that's where we are. I mean, like what Scott said is it does rely still on, subsidies from the government or incentives from the government at this point.
Darren, we're almost out of time here. There is a foreign policy debate between President Obama and Governor Romney on Monday night. We've been talking about energy. What question do you think they should be asked when it comes to energy and foreign policy?
That's a great question. I don't know that they're going to get much on that topic, mm-hmm. but you're certainly hearing a lot from the climate change activists, people who want to see a question on that. They wanted one during the last debate there in Long Island and didn't get one, and they are planning protests down in Florida, obviously a place where sea level rise is an issue. And
sure.
Obviously climate change is an international issue. It was one of those issues, I think, if you think back about a decade ago, that President Bush got into some of his biggest heat on before 9/11 for walking away from the Kyoto Protocol and how that upset a lot of our allies in Europe. So, a Romney administration coming in and walking back on a lot of the climate promises of the last 8 years, I'm sorry, 4 years, and even in the final years of the Bush administration would certainly set off some political, danger points for a Romney administration. So a climate question could be very interesting if it gets asked. Again, I don't know if they'll go there, but it's certainly ripe for the picking.
Well, we'll find out Monday night. Darren Samuelson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Susan Phillips, thank you so much for joining us as well. Darren Samuelson, a White House reporter for Politico, and Susan Phillips, reporter for State Impact PA. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.